go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. As always, we are joined by our super producer. Today, it is Alex Grabbag Williams.
Grabbag. That's good.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Not our best work.
Well, seems like recently we've been saying that a lot. Like, we come up with a nickname and we think, well, it's not all that great, is it? And I think it's because we come up with it, you know, off the cuff, like on the fly.
Well, what was that? Was it Burns or Dunn, the poet who said, man's reach must exceed his grasp, else what's a heaven for? You know, kind of a aim for the stars, land in the clouds.
Oh, thing. Nice, Ben. I'm impressed.
It's been a very philosophical week for me, Scott.
I bring in all this silly stuff, and you're quoting poets and great authors.
This is great is a matter of opinion. just no matter what your high school English teacher told you.
Okay.
And this is not silly. This is interesting stuff. This is, for you and I, one of our favorite recurring segments or episode formats. Nuts and bolts.
Yeah. And this time, I'm primarily going to focus on, just some kind of, I guess, weird, wacky news, if you want to call it that, because it just seems like there's so much of the stuff that comes across my desk just about every day, that it's hard to ignore a lot of these, and they don't really, you know, take up the space of a full show, really. We can't talk for an hour about some of these things.
Right.
Maybe we could. You never know. We stretch things quite a bit, right? All our sidebars and everything. But, you know, in this case, we're going to take maybe, I don't know, five or six different things that I have, and you're going to, you know, add some email, flair to this whole thing, I guess, because we get a lot of email now as well, and have for the last 9 or 10 years. But this is one of those things where we just use to catch up on everything and maybe clear out the inbox a little bit.
Yeah. And I have a couple of surprises for you, Scott, and hopefully they'll be surprising to our producer, Alex, and to you, ladies and gentlemen. So no spoilers, except for one of the things has nothing to do with automobiles.
Oh,
nothing to do with transit. It's just a weird news story, and I wanted to see your reaction.
Oh, wow.
Okay. We'll save it for, at least after a break at some point.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. So what do you got?
Well, let's dive right in here, and there's going to be many of these, so this isn't the whole show by any means, but we're going to first talk about an article that I ran across from a place called autoguide.com, and it also is on other sites, like I think it's on Wikilander and places like that. The 10 cars most likely to have been in an accident.
Oh, yeah, I remember this one.
Now, this is, and listen to the title again, it's important that you get it. The 10 cars most likely to have been in an accident. So this is something you want to keep in mind if you're in the market for a used car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea is that when you're out buying a used car, something that's not, you know, well, not brand new from the factory, not brand new on the lot.
Right.
Something that's used, you don't know the overall condition of the car really until you kind of dig into some of the details of it. Now, some of those details can be found, with, different sites like, you know, AutoCheck or Carfax or places like that, which will give you accident reports, right?
Right. Or a title search can get rid of some of the salvage, flood, in insurance write-off stuff.
Exactly right. Now, here's the problem with that, though, is that you and I both know that not every time you get in an accident, you take this to the insurance company and say, I've been in an accident. You don't report every single accident because, hey, you know, your uncle does, body work and, you know, little paint and buff work and stuff like that. And you can get some of the stuff just taken care of at the small time shops in town.
Yeah. Or even if it's a little cosmetic paint scrape, you can probably go do a touch up yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and there are even some people out there that are good enough with Bondo that, you know, they can do this in their own garage and, you know, no one's the wiser. So,
right.
There are some tricks out there really. And really there are two types of accidents, and we'll get to the types of cars that are most likely. They've actually ranked them, and I'll tell you how they came about that, you know, the methodology in just a minute. But there are two types that we talked about. There's reported and there's unreported. And I think we kind of covered that just a moment ago. But they used that information in this study to develop this chart, this top 10 chart that we're looking at right now, both you and I are looking at, of the 10 most likely vehicles to be in an accident. And here's how big the sample was, Ben. 2.4 million vehicles between the ages of, I guess, the 2009 model year and newer. So anything from 2009 up until this was written in 2017. So I'm going to guess, you know, probably a 2017 model year if I had to guess. There's the thing. They used Experian AutoCheck to examine whether a vehicle had a reported accident, and to identify an unreported accident, they used auction condition reports, which is smart. So there's a lot of cars out there for, you know, on auction or at auction rather.
Right. Yeah.
And they used those reports that showed more than one metal body panel with signs of paintwork, but where the auto check report did not show an accident. So, in other words, they know something's going on with that car.
Yeah.
They can see, you know, the waviness in the paint or whatever. You know, they can – a trained expert can spot that kind of thing.
Right. And those are the people conducting those auction condition reports. I think that's smart. I think that's a good way to construct the net here to gather the sample size.
Yeah, I think it's a decent size too. I have 2.4 million vehicles and, again, spanning many model years. So – the way that this chart is laid out, so everybody knows there's a make and model, and we'll tell you that, a percentage of reported accidents, and then a percentage of unreported accidents, and then that makes a percentage of overall accidents, okay? So we'll try to read these in a way that makes sense, and I don't know if we need to read every single one of them. We'll just go through the list 10 to 1, I guess, if you want to do it that way. The most likely vehicle will be the last one we read. But according to the study, this is number 10, 8% of Infiniti QX60 SUVs have been in reported accidents, while another 5.5% have been in unreported accidents, which makes a total of
13.5%.
Okay, so that's the number 10 vehicle on our list, and that's the way all of these go. And, you know, the numbers aren't really changing dramatically between the percentage of reported accidents and percentage of unreported accidents between 10 and 1. It's just that when we get to the top, you know, the first one here on our list, the number 10, is at 13.5% of those vehicles have been in an accident of some sort, either reported or unreported. When, by the time we get up to the number 1, it's 18.5%.
Yes.
So, you know, it's 1 in 5 chance that that vehicle that you're buying has been in an accident of the type that we're going to tell you in a moment. But let's go from 10 to number 1.
Okay, so we'll laundry list some this now that everybody knows how the system works.
I hope.
I hope so too.
Yeah, it's a little confusing when you're not looking at the chart.
But I also want to know what you all think about the types of cars, because I think this may later play into some of the driver stereotypes car stereotypes you talked about before.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so next we have the Lexus CT200H, 13.6% chance that it has been in an accident if you buy it used.
And then there's the Cadillac ATS, which comes in at number 8. And that is – there's a 14.1% chance that that has been in an accident before you buy that car.
Mm-hmm. And don't throw stones on that statistic if you drive an Audi A5, because you have bought a car with a – there's a 14.2% chance it had an accident if you bought it used.
All right. So these are just creeping up, right? So then the Lexus RX 350 comes in at 14.4.
It's our second Lexus.
Yeah. And then the Infiniti JX comes in at 14.6.
Second Infiniti.
Yeah. And then there's the Jaguar XJ, which comes in at, this is going up again, 15.7%.
And now we're in the top three.
Okay, the top three. So number three is the Range Rover Evoque. And that comes in at 16.5% chance that that has been in an accident, either reported or unreported, before you buy that used car.
And we do want to say before we get to the top two, which I think are, there's some gallows humor here. This is the stereotype stuff we're talking about. Before we get to those top two though, we do want to say that the good news is in every example, the percentage of accidents that were reported remains higher than the percentage of unreported accidents.
Yes, yes. All right, so number two is a BMW X1, and that comes in at 18%. That's pretty high.
That is pretty high. Yeah. And number one, if we could have a drum roll, Alex.
Oh, we got a live drum roll. How's that?
That's great. I'm all feeling right. It.
The BMW 4 Series.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. The BMW 4 Series coming in at 18.5%, which means, as Scott said, you can just call it close enough for government work and say you've got a 1 in 5 chance.
Oh my gosh. Is that unbelievable? A 1 in 5 chance that a BMW 4 Series has been in a wreck. Now again, the reported accidents are about 11.5% of that total, of that 18.5, and the unreported accidents are about 7%. So the odds are a little bit greater that it has been in a reported accident, which is, I guess, a little consolation. Slight.
And so, sure, there could be better methodology behind some of the data here, but I think it's pretty solid. And I think for those of us in the audience who have a low opinion of BMWs, not me personally, I want to take pains with that. I'm actually a fan of virtually every single thing that floats, flies, swims, or drives, with one notable exception, which we do not need to dwell on today. But
yeah, we all know.
But we do know there's a bit of a stereotype sometimes for BMW drivers.
Yeah, sure there is. And I also am a fan of BMWs, but maybe not of every BMW driver. How about that?
Okay, yeah.
Not of everyone, but again, broad strokes. You can't say everybody acts or reacts the same way. So, you know which one you are.
Remember, you know which one you are.
Oh man,
Shots fired.
I guess so. But you know, here's the thing, Ben, with all these numbers that were thrown out there, the percentages and the chart and everything, I think that if our listeners go to autoguide.com and check out that chart, that's maybe the best way to kind of make all this make sense in their head.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is true with a lot of the stuff, but maybe not for the second thing here because this one is just this is mind-blowing every time we talk about it, because we have talked about expensive parking spaces in the past, and this is a record setter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, record setter for China.
Yes. In the past, the episode you're alluding to is we looked at the world's most expensive parking space, which at the time of the episode was in Boston. Right?
Yeah. Oh boy, that's a long time ago. It sounds right.
And it's changed. This title has changed before. There was one in Boston. There was a very expensive one in London, and then later in the Middle East. And now we're in China.
Yeah. And, we'll also talk about some other things here along the way too. But, there is a parking spot in Hong Kong that was recently sold. Now, very recently, these articles come from around mid-June of this year, 2017.
Yeah.
A parking spot in Hong Kong that sold for $5.18 million, which –
Hong Kong dollars.
Well, it's Hong Kong dollars. So I shouldn't have led with that number maybe because there's a less impressive U.S. dollar, but it's still impressive really.
What's the U.S. equivalency?
$664,200.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's 5.18 million Hong Kong dollars. But that does set a record in the city where authorities say they are struggling to contain soaring property prices. Now, the parking spot is in Western Hong Kong Island, and it was sold to a guy named Quan Wai Ming on May 31st. And, the land registry is where they looked this up. And I looked into this Quan Wai Ming guy.
Uh-huh.
And it turns out that he is an executive director of an investment stock corporation in Hong Kong. And he's got interests all over the world, really. I mean, I'll tell you what he's got. In Hong Kong alone, he already has two apartments and two parking spots in the same building with a total value of about $10 million already. So this $664,000 is sort of a drop in the bucket, just looking for a space to park a third vehicle maybe.
$10 million U.S.?
$10 million. I think that's $10 million U.S., yes. He also has property investments in New York's Greenwich Village that range in the total of somewhere around $26 million. And each each parking spot in that area, in that part of Greenwich Village that he's in, I guess, I don't know if it's an apartment complex, a condo, or what it is exactly, but
yeah.
Each parking spot is worth about $1 million. So this Greenwich Village place that he has for $26 million, uh-huh. or sold for $26 million, that included the $1 million parking spot along with it.
Oh.
And,
well,
it's crazy, but it seems that everybody that owns property in that area is paying approximately $1 million for a parking spot. I had no idea that the rates had gone that high in that part of New York.
Supply and demand, my friend.
I guess so. And, you know, the funny thing is they point out here that Hong Kong is a crazy expensive place to live. It's sort of like living in downtown Manhattan, I guess, if the equivalent for here in the United States.
Yeah, it's one of the most expensive property markets on the planet. And if you have some spare time and a strong stomach, you can search with your preferred internet browser for the slums of Hong Kong.
Yeah, the slums of Hong Kong. Yeah, sure.
But
I was going to tell you how expensive it is.
Oh, please.
They say that in Hong Kong, what they call a nano apartment.
Oh, yeah.
It's about 200 square feet. It's about $500,000 U.S. dollars.
And barring any economic catastrophe, prices, especially for real estate, which does include parking spaces, seems only set to rise in Hong Kong.
Now that's the size of a tiny. I had a 200 square foot studio apartment.
Are you serious?
I paid nowhere close to $500,000 for it. I can guarantee you that.
Where was this?
It was in Royal Oak, Michigan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a 200-square-foot apartment.
I did, yeah. It was a tiny little place above – it was above the boiler for the entire apartment building. Everybody else had regular-sized apartments. I had this little room that they made into a studio apartment. It's kind of a ridiculous place. It had a – in the bathroom, everything was like I don't want to say half size. It was like three-quarter size, everything.
Oh, wow.
Bathtub, you know, the sink, the toilet, Everything. It was all shrunken down. It had like kind of smart features like, you know, the fold-out table from the wall that you could fold. It kind of like
a Murphy bed?
A Murphy bed, only it wasn't.
But like it's a Murphy table.
It's a Murphy table, yeah, for a dining table and, you know, like built-in, you know, dresser drawers and things like that.
Yeah.
I actually made pretty good use of the space. I had a lot of stuff crammed in there and I had room to move. It was comfortable.
Were you there for more than a year?
I was there for about 6 months.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I could have lived there for a couple of years, I think.
You got kicked out.
The only thing really, I didn't get kicked out. No, I didn't. The only thing probably the most uncomfortable about that was, you know, the heat from that boiler. You just never knew when it was going to hit. So, you know, even though I had air conditioning in the apartment.
Sure.
Sometimes it would just be ridiculously hot and you couldn't cool it off in there.
Because of the boiler.
The boiler right below the floorboards. Yeah. Yeah, kind of crazy, but 200 square feet for $500,000 in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And again, $1 million parking spots. And this one, I guess, I mean, they say that this is a, well, not million in Hong Kong, I guess, $664,200.
Right.
But, man, it seems like the trend is only going up.
It's true. You're absolutely right. And let's keep in mind that while you may have been relatively comfortable, as a, you know, a young man out on the scene in his nano apartment living by himself, a lot of people living in these nano apartments are living with a family or a spouse or a kid, you know.
Oh, I can't imagine cramming yourself into a space that tight with more than one person and at that price, you know, knowing that you paid that price to be there. It's just unbelievable. And I didn't call mine a nano apartment, by the way. It was just a studio apartment.
Right, right.
Just a plain old vanilla studio apartment.
Well, I bet you there's a difference there in category. I bet that there are studio apartments, but they're larger.
Yeah, I guess so. Aren't there also I guess maybe this is something you just rent for the night or the week maybe, but the honeycomb looking ones that you can only lay down in them?
The capsule hotels?
Oh, that's it, the capsule hotels. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that would be a much more short-term thing, but it's just a place to sleep really. And they're pretty interesting too if you want to look up you know, cities that are crowded and have to deal with very small space for a lot of people to kind of cram in overnight and sleep. And it's a good solution, but I mean, anybody who's claustrophobic could not do it. And
that's what I was
thinking. Speaking of claustrophobic, I guess maybe this would be a good time to take a break because our next topic has to do with, enclosing something.
That's true. And I couldn't agree with you more. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
And we're back, and I didn't mean to be morbid when we went out of the last segment of our show here, but
it's a morbid thing.
It is. I mean, the next topic here, I guess there's just no way around. Let's just jump into it and see what we think. But we've talked about car burials in the past, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And you know, people that are socialites, you know, people well known in the community that have been buried in unusual vehicles because that was kind of their thing, their signature vehicle that they drove around town. I don't want to say one true love, but
they were trademark.
Exactly, they were priceless to them. Sandra West and her Ferrari, I think, is one of them that comes to mind immediately. We've talked about other people that just have had, you know, a car that's not even remarkable to most people, and they want to be buried in it. You know, like an old Bonneville or an old, you know,
a Cadillac.
Something like that. Something that, you know, makes a statement, I guess.
So what I think is interesting about this is that while it might sound silly or morbid on the surface, or some people might say it's even wasteful, right? For the people who want this, you got to think of it kind of like someone who says, I want to get buried with my favorite watch that I've had since I was a kid. Or, you know, for some people, if you get accustomed enough to a car that you have, it becomes like an article of clothing.
Yeah, final wishes for people are very important. I mean, I think it's something that that gives them comfort towards the end of their life. And this man's comfort that we're going to talk about was the knowledge that he was going to be buried in his Harley Davidson sidecar. And this is a guy out of Pennsylvania. I think he was in Steel City, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, yeah. Arthur Smokey Werner Jr., right?
Yeah, yeah. And he recently died. He recently passed away. Now, he was 89 years old, and he was a Steel City resident. His name was, yeah, Arthur Werner Sr.
And Smokey to his friends.
Smokey to his friends, yes, good point. But he died of cancer, I think it was in late June of this year, of 2017, and his last wish was to be buried in the sidecar of his 1990 Harley-Davidson Heritage Softail. Mm. And there's a photo of Arthur Sr. here on his motorcycle, and he was a much younger man at the time, not a lot younger, but somewhat younger, and a sidecar right next to him on this Harley. And it's a big sidecar. It's not a tiny little sidecar. It looks like almost like a recumbent type design where you could lay down in it. It's got a windshield on it. It's pretty nice. Matches the bike.
Yeah.
But the thing is that this guy, this is how important this motorcycle was to him. He bought the Harley with his retirement bonus after he had worked 42 years at a place called Bethlehem Steel as a welder. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is like his retirement dream. He probably spent a lot of time on the bike. As his daughter-in-law, Cindy Werner, said, he lived for the bike. So it was kind of his, you know, trademark thing, his signature thing to ride around town in. And I guess just recently, this place called in Pennsylvania, this place called Heintzelman Funeral Home, carried out that last wish for him. And not only that, they did something really unusual. And this led me to another search for a vehicle that I had never heard of until this week.
Go for it.
So this is the crazy. So he's buried in his sidecar. I don't even know how to put this together, I guess. The funeral company has motorcycle hearses.
Yeah. Supervisor David Heintzelman is a bike enthusiast himself. And he and his brother Robert, who run the funeral home, have three motorcycle hearses in their own fleet.
Now, I think these vary in design, and I can't track down whether or not it's this exact funeral home or not, but I did see the picture of this sidecar in another sidecar. So the motorcycle hearse design is such that there's a rider, an employee of the funeral company. And he's riding, and there's a hearse, like a carriage next to him, a big glass carriage next to him. It's huge, that would normally have a casket in it. They were able to fit the entire sidecar in this. So it's very, it's strange to see a sidecar within a sidecar being carried by a black motorcycle hearse.
At very a strange. Funeral, with a body inside.
With a body inside. Now, so this is really interesting. You can find photos of this, but until, again, about 2 or 3 days ago, I had never heard of a motorcycle hearse.
I hadn't either until you showed me this. And I do want to correct something. I think at the top, I may have misspoke and said Arthur Smokey Werner Jr. Smokey is the son.
Oh.
And Werner Sr. is the deceased. But
so we're hoping Smokey's still around.
Yeah, Smokey should still be around. And if you're listening, man, that's very impressive because I'm sure he had to search to find this very specific funeral home to fulfill this last wish.
Yeah, and what a last wish. I mean, it's very fitting, I think. It's one of those it's nice. I mean, again, I didn't mean to be morbid when we were taking the break there or anything, but this is one of those interesting stories that only comes along every so often. And, you know, because we're focused on cars, trucks, motorcycles, airplanes, boats, whatever, this thing just falls right in our wheelhouse. I figured we'd talk about it today. And I'm sure there's probably others out there, others that will happen later this year. Maybe we'll, you know, pick them up for another nuts and bolts in the future.
Let me ask you this, Scott, for the next direction for us to go.
Okay.
I'm going to offer you a choice.
Oh, okay.
We can go to some listener feedback on some past episodes, which are pretty, we've got some great stuff here in the queue, or we can double down on the morbidity just for a bit.
Oh, man. Okay.
And I promise you, if you choose the latter, if you choose to double down on the dark side here, then I will find a nice thing after that.
Okay, let's do that then.
Okay. All right.
We'll just knock it out all at once.
All right. Well, we might go back to it later, but
you never know. We tend to do that.
Yeah, it's true. but only as the show requires. Here's something I found that I thought would be a particular interest, and I don't know, how much we had done on this before. I think we may have talked about in the past. Did we ever do anything on the cars that serial killers drove?
Oh, man. It seems like we have mentioned them. It does. Yes. It does sound familiar.
It seems like we've mentioned them. And I went through a period where I was trying to track down, given different reports and news stories throughout the decades here in the U.S., I was trying to track down when the stereotype of the windowless murder van came about.
Oh,
you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, the sketchy van driving around the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. And I was trying to find – and I had trouble finding that because, you know, it's like a cultural trope, right?
Mm-hmm.
You feel like you see it more in crime shows than you do in the real world,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
One thing I found that was a genuine – the closest thing I found was that Jeffrey Dahmer allegedly did have a van, but it had a window.
Really?
Yeah, but he did have a blue van because he was working for a floral delivery company.
A blue van. But it had kind of like – you know those windows that are like all fogged up because someone's smoking inside? You know what I mean? Like a real dirty looking van.
Yeah.
It's what I'm picturing right away. And a weird shaped – window probably.
And I was trying to find the model of the van, still looking into it, but apparently the big link there comes from, again, this is morbid, folks. It comes from when Dahmer was temporarily linked to the kidnapping and murder of Adam Walsh in Hollywood, Florida.
Yeah.
And as you know, his father went on to helm America's Most Wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So this would have been a widespread report of a van that maybe would have linked it in people's minds to these types of crimes.
Hmm.
So maybe that's where the stereotype comes from.
That's an interesting link. I could see that being the case.
I thought it was an interesting link. And
you know, there are sites out there that are called like the sketchy van or something
yeah,
like that. You know, and
yeah.
they have photos of kind of shifty looking vehicles that are parked all around their town. And, you know, of course, when everybody's, you know, contributing to that
yeah.
site, there's a lot of them out there.
Mismatched.
Yeah,
hubcaps,
some that, you know,
weird stuff painted on
like
the side.
Free candy painted on the side.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, some that go for that, you know, that, yeah. that they want that mysterious look. You know?
I'm glad you sold that one, by the way. There are better ways to give away surplus candy. Okay, the last one, because I know we looked at a little bit at like Bonnie and Clyde's vehicle, and I think we may have mentioned.
What about the DC sniper vehicle? Because that was made into like a sniper nest.
It was customized.
Yeah,
yeah,
customized in a way. And a lot of, you know, you'll find a lot of the serial killer cars have been customized in some way, in some dastardly way, you know, that is really, really creepy. I mean, look at Bundy's vehicles. I mean, those were also modified. I think he had removed, door locks and handles and even
yeah.
seats, you know,
and
to make room.
He had kits hidden in it.
Yeah.
Supply kits.
Oh, you know, every time we talk about these, every time we mention this, I have to think of this. Like every time we read about somebody who gets caught in a true crime book, you know, and they describe what they found in the vehicle.
It's always the stuff you could plausibly use for a car.
Every
repair.
Time. Every single time. It's almost like the kits that we told our listeners to build to put in their car. It's like, you know, a good pair of gloves. Check.
Duct tape.
Yeah, yeah. Some rope.
Check.
Yeah, yeah. You got a flashlight.
Light,
yeah.
You got crowbar.
A knife to cut the rope, right?
Yeah.
You need
yeah.
that. Yeah, crowbar. Is another good one.
Maybe some flares or yeah. some matches.
A black ski mask just in case it's cold. Just kidding.
Right.
I'm just kidding on that one.
A hammer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hammer. Yeah, sure. Why not a small hammer or something like ball peen hammer?
So I guess what Scott and I are saying is that we sincerely apologize if we accidentally told you to build a murder kit.
You know, it does. It happens every time I'm reading a true crime book. They say, like, here's what we found the suspect with, you know, at the time of his arrest. And it's always like this super helpful, handy kit.
But there are some things that are clearly, you know, like there were torn strips of bed sheet and handcuffs.
Okay. Well,
but
you're walking the edge.
Yeah. That I think is a little bit too far. You would be in a Lucy, you got some splaining to do situation. But if you, but I was thinking about this too. What's the push in the other direction? And I think it's emergency food. If you feel like your roadside repair and survival kit is looking a little bit too murdery, you know, throw in like an MRE or some granola or some dehydrated food.
Yeah, some family pictures. Wait, yeah. No, that gets even creepier.
Only if you're in them. You have
you know,
to be in them.
Everything I add makes it worse.
I think maybe I should be in charge of just for this team. I think maybe I should be point man on the kit building.
I mean, a length of clothesline, you know, just in case. Now, darn it.
Yeah.
Nothing works.
Piano wire for tying transmissions.
Okay.
All right. Moving on.
All right. How about something a little bit lighter?
Yeah. Let's do that.
This one comes from Autoblog, autoblog.com. And this is, well, it's Renault. We don't have Renault here in the United States anymore. We did at some point. It may come back. You never know. But Renault, this is really strange, Ben. Renault thinks that the colors that they've made available for a vehicle that they call the Twingo hatchback make for pretty fashionable nail polish as well.
True story.
Yeah.
This is interesting. So they're launching a line of nail polish in, what is it, four?
Yeah.
Four shades?
Four shades. It's yellow, red, black, and then a very pale blue. And these four shades, or these four colors, happen to be the exact same paint that they use on their Renault Twingo.
Mm-hmm. And because they all match the paint exactly, they also work with a different purpose.
Yeah, they can also be touch-up paint for your vehicle because they match exactly. Now, this is strange. It's a strange thought. It's an interesting idea, too. So if you're out and about the town, you get a little nick in your car and you happen to have, you know, your matching nail polish on you or in your purse or in your back pocket or whatever, you can just use the nail polish as touch-up paint as well for your vehicle and you know, check out your nails, make sure they're in good shape as well. It's the exact same color, the exact same paint.
Yeah, and it's strange because if it's touch-up paint, then it would have to be really durable, right? So how would people get it off their nails?
Yeah, like, I guess that's trouble.
I have a lot of questions with this. I applaud somebody going for a unique and interesting product. I do wonder, you know, who it's for. If you're listening and you think this is for me, I was looking for this. I'm tired of getting rooked at the paint store. And then having to go to a nail place
for this, for the single use paint.
Yeah. Then you can get what was essentially multifunctional paint, for less than $10.
Yeah. It's about $9.92 at current exchange rates. Now that is, as of June of 2017.
Right.
But you can order this online. I guess Renault has an online store and, you know, these four shades are available there. And if you have never seen a Twingo, Twingo looks a little bit, sort of like a smaller, maybe like a Volkswagen GTI. I'm trying to think of something or a Golf. Something that, U.S. listeners can put
this in more Golf
perspective, I guess. Yeah, it's similar. It's not exact.
It's not exact.
But it's close enough to that, that shape and size of vehicle. Interesting though. I mean, now the Twingo, of course, we can't get it in the States. If we could, I mean, I guess if you like the paint, you know, the nail polish, you can still order that. You can still use that in the United States, right?
Sure.
There's no crime in doing that.
I mean, you don't have to shake you down for that.
No, you don't have to worry about airbags and all that other stuff, you know, that they're concerned about, or bumper height or whatever.
This could also make either a classy or hilarious gift to one of your friends who owns a Twingo, depending on their position on nail polish.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, I want to mention another vehicle that I've seen this a lot in my travels. It's called a Renault Twizy. And I don't know if you've ever seen a Twizy or not. I bet a lot of our European listeners have, or, you know, in the European region, I should say. They're built in Spain. It's an electric commuter car. It has a range of about 62 miles. And this is an interesting car. It's all electric, like I said.
Yeah.
But it has that tandem seating position that you and I both find kind of interesting.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's a really neat-looking vehicle. It's a three-door hatchback, rear engine, rear-wheel drive as well, weighs less than 1,000 pounds. And this is a common rental car over in a lot of cities in Europe, throughout Europe. But it's just a cool-looking little vehicle that I think a lot of our listeners may not have ever seen before. I figured I'd throw it out there while we're talking about Renault, because we just don't get to see many of them here, you know, since the Renault Encore days back and the Del Fuego.
Oh,
remember
wow,
those?
Yeah,
it was a long time ago. But
Del Fuego.
Well, you never know. They may come back. We'll see.
And speaking of coming back, we will return after a word from our sponsor. And we're back.
That's much better.
This is funny to us because I tried to do a more interesting, or I guess elaborate, return for the break.
Didn't work out so well.
Whew, it was a whiff.
Yeah,
it was
well,
a brick.
Yeah.
But
stick with the "and we're back."
I think we're going to stick with "And We're Back."
The song and dance thing. I mean, it doesn't translate well.
You know, I should have thought of that. Yeah, I should have thought
kind of
that.
Of a visual thing.
It is. Okay. Well, let me get the rest of the team out, guys. We're not doing the intro song.
You can take off the tap shoes now.
All right. I'm going to keep them on.
That might actually translate. That might
well,
be okay.
I didn't bring other shoes.
Oh, okay. So, it's going to be distracting when you're leaving here.
Yeah, it's true.
Click, clack down the hallway.
So speaking of fantastic and relevant segues.
Oh, yeah, it's relevant.
You want to hear some listener mail?
Yes, please.
All right, great.
We made it this far without listener mail?
We made it this far.
Wow. And there's a lot of listener
mail.
We've
got to at least have a couple in here.
All right, sounds good.
All right, so Frank writes to us. And Frank says, I recently listened to your episode on icebreakers. Thought I'd offer some insight into the U.S. icebreaking fleet that might interest you and your listeners. All the icebreakers the U.S. currently operates are run by the U.S. Coast Guard and not the Navy, to which, to the best of my knowledge, has never operated a single icebreaker. However, we could argue that the Navy's fleet of nuclear submarines, which are referred to as boats by the Navy, Navy surface ships are referred to as ships, could be considered pseudo-icebreakers since they have and continue to operate under the Arctic regions of the North Pole and have occasionally surfaced there for various reasons, one of which I'm sure is to make sure Santa Claus is still doing his job up there in the North Pole.
Oh, he's talking about the ones that you'll see sometimes that just blast through
10
feet of ice, it seems like.
And just
what a cool image.
Up.
Very cool image.
Yes. So he tells us, I'm just going to read some excerpts on this, but I'm going to read some of the highlights here. So he says the Coast Guard has different missions for its icebreakers, aside from checking up on residents of the North Pole. A large part of an icebreaker's duties include keeping sea, lake, and river lanes open for ships and commerce, and that's mainly performed by the inland icebreakers operating on the Great Lakes and in the interior U.S. river systems. The seagoing icebreakers, the Polar Sea, the Polar Star, and the Healy, all operate out of Seattle and spend most of their time ferrying scientific equipment and scientists to research stations in the Arctic. And he included a couple pictures of the Polar Sea, which he says is now in long-term storage due to lack of funding to repair and maintain it, leaving only two ocean-going icebreakers in operation for the entire U.S. fleet. As we saw in our previous episode, Russia is still, like, on the forefront.
So they're blowing us out of the water.
They're cracking us under the ice.
That's right? A better saying, sure.
So before I move on to the more interesting stuff about the mechanics of these seagoing icebreakers, let me just make a few points on the consequences of having too few icebreakers in the fleet and not maintaining them. The most obvious is not having enough platforms to perform the missions, especially as more of the sea ice in the Arctic melts due to climate change. There will inevitably be an increase in commerce throughout the regions, and the U.S. will not have the resources to keep the shipping lanes ice-free or, worse, be unable to respond to ships in distress. Secondly, neglecting these icebreakers due to funding and having them tied up at the pier on a long-term basis means crews are losing valuable experience. Navigating through the ice and icebreaking is mostly an exercise in experience, and if you don't practice, you lose your expertise in this area. Also, just as an aside, some of the engineers that run these ships are the type that you might hear in terms of such famous or infamous phrases as, "Here, hold my beer," or "Hey, watch this." It might be in the public's best interest to keep these guys out in the ice, happily ramming ice with a large ship and not on the local lakes in their own personal watercraft, if you get my drift.
So these are the seagoing cowboys, really.
Yeah. I mean, you have to – they're adventurous. They're also have highly experienced.
Yeah.
You know, and this is a rarefied skill set, as Frank is telling us. And Frank goes on to give us an inside look at the mechanics of icebreaker operation and at some of the implications of lack of funding for maintenance and repair.
Oh, sure. I mean, who knew that the U.S. only had two remaining, icebreakers that are still in service. I had no idea that was the case. But it is interesting, pretty eye-opening. Now, Frank is a U.S. Coast Guard member, right?
Or yes. Yeah.
He, either active or past. I'm not sure.
He works on or around icebreakers regularly as part of his Coast Guard Reserve drill weekends.
Oh, very good. All right. So yeah. Frank has inside knowledge and we appreciate it. That's very informative. Thank you.
And thanks for the awesome pictures too.
Yeah, exactly. I remember seeing that email. Very, very cool photos.
So what's next?
Well, I got a couple of things here. I've got one that, I'm going to tell you right up front. Here, I think we're just going to kind of blow past this one, but watch for this topic to come up as it's, maybe it's its own episode or
I know this
one. As something that is part of a bigger episode maybe. I just had the idea. If we had a little less time before this this episode that we're recording right now, we probably would have stuffed this one in here, but the more I thought about it, the more I thought this would be an interesting topic kind of standalone.
Yeah.
There is a full-size rubber band powered dragster that was at one time taken out to Bonneville, and they were going to make a land speed record attempt with a rubber band powered dragster. And this is in 2008.
And this is a real thing.
It's a real thing. And this happened. This is an article in Jalopnik. And again, the more I thought about this, the more I thought, well, this could be incorporated into a different episode, maybe where we talk about alternative power vehicles, but not so much like, you know, the hydrogen, electric,
right,
you know, that type of thing.
Solar or whatever.
Yes, soy cars or whatever. This is, I want to talk about cars that are propelled by, you know, AAA batteries.
Vegetable oil.
Yeah, exactly. Or, in this case, 150 rubber bands. How interesting is that?
Uh-huh.
They were going to go for a speed record on the Bonneville Salt Flats in 2008 with a rubber band powered dragster.
Well, that's also a heck of a qualifier or a caveat, because if they're the first rubber band powered vehicle to go on the salt flats.
Yeah. Bingo. Record. Yeah. Land speed record.
You just got to watch out for some hot shot guy who's got 153 rubber bands.
Well, but the thing is, how do you get a vehicle that's powered with 150 rubber bands to carry you the distance that it has to go, you know, between the traps? I think it has to go a mile between the traps. So, you know, at a certain rate of speed, and they have to do it both directions. So, it seems like it's a very interesting story here. And I thought it might make a, you know, better segment in a bigger show about these alternative powered vehicles, because there's some really bizarre ones out there. Strange powered vehicles that, that don't fall into the normal alternative power, sources that we normally think of, you know, like the vehicles that can travel in the flex lanes here in the city.
Yeah, it gets way stranger than you might expect.
Yeah, pretty weird. So, I do have some other stuff, and so, you know, even though we're kind of dumping out of that one, I've got two things left really in front of me here, and I'll give you a choice. There's one that you don't know about.
All right.
Then there's another one that you do know about, and it's. It's of personal nature, Ben. It's my project car.
Yeah, let's see
so
that one.
You want to do that one first?
Yeah, because, okay, so longtime listeners know that you have, since time immemorial, had a Chrysler Newport in your garage.
Yeah.
And you have assiduously been repairing this car, and you have also done some pretty fascinating experiments. You made it a bare steel car.
Yeah.
Which we do have an episode on. You can check out at carstuffshow.com.
Yeah. Many years ago now.
Many years ago. Don't remind me.
Yeah.
But, you've been making some big moves on the car recently.
Yeah. You know, and that's after, I'm going to tell you, years and years of excuses, procrastination, the typical project car pitfalls.
Well, I would say some of them were reasons.
Well, I guess. There are reasons, but, you know, this car falls into that category of, you know, I probably should have known better when I bought it. I mean, I knew that time was going to get tight, because I bought it when we got our house recently. It was many years ago. And I should have known that along with the house comes a lot of extra work and a lot of extra, you know, responsibilities with, you know, of course the kids in high school now, and, you know, there's this busy schedules and work schedules. And, you know, we've kind of ramped it up here. We've moved twice, I think, since, in our office, right?
Yeah.
Moved twice, I think, since I bought this thing. But it's been years and years, and I've just always put it off, and, you know, it's been kind of something that's just always bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm to the point, and I'll tell you why I'm working on it. And we won't spend too much time on what I've done here, but
sure.
The reason that I'm getting rid of it is my kid is going to start driving soon, or is driving, and we'll have another vehicle to, fill up our driveway with. And we can't have four vehicles to jockey around all the time. It's going to be too difficult. Mm-hmm. Three is hard enough. But, you know, with this car continually, always having one of the parking spots in the garage. It hasn't really moved.
Newport's big.
And it hasn't moved. Yeah, it's like 19 feet long, or almost 19 feet. So it takes up the entire half of the garage, my half, I guess, if you want to call it that.
So wait, are you going to sell this?
I'm getting it ready to sell. Yeah.
Oh, man.
So the reason I'm getting it running is to sell it. And the good part here is that I got it running and driving again. It's actually, it moves out of the driveway now.
Awesome.
Which is cool. And it's been a lot of fun. I've been cruising around the neighborhood a little bit with it, mm-hmm. but I've done a few things to it. It's still, you know, bare metal. It's still, shiny metal.
And still got the marine gas tank, right?
Yeah, still has marine. I put a new one in. Okay. That's one of the things I did. And it's much in much better condition than it was before. I've handled it, I guess. I've engineered the, if you want to call it that.
Did you MacGyver it?
The temporary tank is in a much better place now, and it's in a lot better condition, and there's no danger the way I've done it. And I'll try to describe that, but I've done like a new battery, and I got a trickle charger for it, because, you know, it's one of those cars that you start up for 5 minutes and shut down, and start it up again and shut it down,
and
it kills the battery. So I got a new trickle charger. I put in a new brake booster, a master cylinder, which was a huge stumbling block for me to get it out of the garage, because it always ran. It just didn't run well.
Run smoothly.
I couldn't stop, you know, and I have a driveway that has a hill, so I would have taken out maybe, you know, the electrical box, my neighbor's car, maybe, I don't know, you know, other stuff on the way out. But that's all taken care of now, so it works well. As you've mentioned, a new fuel tank, but it's a marine fuel cell with, you know, the right fittings and the hoses, and everything's routed the right way. And I've got it strapped down, so it's real tight in the corner. And, here's one little concern I had.
What's that?
You know, they always tell you with a poly tank like that, you know, a plastic tank, that you have to put it on the ground in order to fill it at the gas station. You have to take them out of the back end of a pickup truck or the trailer or whatever. So I was concerned that I'm always going to be filling this thing in the trunk, because it's 12 gallons. And I think a gallon of gas is something like, I want to say it's 8 pounds, somewhere around there. So that gets pretty heavy pretty quick. There's no way I'm going to be lifting, 96 pounds in and out of the trunk every time I have to fill it up. And, so I had to figure out a way to ground the nozzle. And I did that with like a braided ground strap. And I went to a clean spot in the chassis, you know, a body ground. Uh-huh. And I made this collar that then I slip into place. And then I put the nozzle in to fill it. So it's the pump is grounded then right to the vehicle, the body, every time I fill it. So I thought it was a smart solution. Maybe I'll put a photo up on Facebook or something of how I did it, if anybody else is in that same spot.
Yeah.
Cause it can be a real hazard, if you're in a similar situation. I think a lot of, you know, project cars, even if it's for a week or so, you know, while they have a temporary tank in place, that's the situation they've got. And this is real simple. It cost me less than $20 to do it.
Now, I want to ask you something that maybe, I know there's a little bit more to say on this. Mm-hmm. You don't have to answer right away. And you can also tell the audience me if this is too personal.
Okay.
Have you estimated the time in man hours that you have spent?
No. No, I don't even know if I could possibly do that, because I hand stripped this car,
right,
using paint stripper and a razor blade. And so I'm not doing it mechanically, really. I'm doing it manually.
And that was an arduous process.
I'll be honest. I still have a little bit left to go on that. I'm not totally done, because when I parked it and the brakes were not in great shape.
Yeah.
That side of the garage, I mean, it's crammed in there tight. Mm-hmm. So I did some of it, and I probably ended up, you know, pulling muscles in my back and neck and everything trying to do it. So now I can turn the car around and take care of part of the other side. I mean,
it was like that back quarter panel?
Yeah, exactly right. I'm very, very close to being done, but it's not totally done, and I have to just get it in a better spot, and it's easy to do now. But, the good thing, and maybe this is where we'll leave off, but,
okay.
Again, it's driving, running. It's a great car. It's a lot of fun, and it's loud, and it will be fast when I get the timing dialed in. But it's a lot of fun. The really cool thing about this is remember when we were doing the bare metal finish episode?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I was telling you, and again, I'm not making any money on this stuff, so don't take this the wrong way. Remember that oil that I was proclaiming was so cool that, you know, like you could paint over it at some future date if you washed it off? Mm-hmm.
But it kept the rust from encroaching on it.
Exactly right. Well, this is how humid it is down here in Atlanta. The tools inside of my toolbox in the garage, mm-hmm. I'll open the drawers and they'll be rusty. Because like the humidity is so intense down here. Mm. So this car, this is years ago when we were talking about this, and I was applying that oil on a fresh, clean surface of metal. And again, 19 feet. You can imagine how much steel there is in this car. Still clean. All I had to do was dust it off and put another coat of oil on it, and it's fine. No rust.
No, but also sheltered from the elements, right?
It was not in the rain, and I would say, you know, I'll tell you that where the garage door goes up and a few raindrops will come onto it if it's, you know, been raining outside on the trunk area, you'll get a little spot of rust eventually if you leave it for a couple of days. Mm. But that rarely happens. I mean, I usually just wipe it off with a rag and it's gone. But this stuff, again, I'm not making a dime on it, but it's called Gibbs brand oil.
Yeah.
And it's the best. It's honestly, it's great. It has worked perfectly, exactly like they said. I don't regret buying the case of oil that I had to buy in order to try it, because that was, you know, the effective way or the most efficient way to buy it, I guess, through the mail. But it's some strong stuff, and I'll post some photos, I guess, of, you know, the way it looks now. And again, it's been bare metal here in Atlanta, and it's humidity, heavy humidity,
sure,
for years and years, and it's still shiny, clean metal.
And for anyone who has yet to experience the dubious pleasure of visiting fair metropolis of Atlanta in the height of summer, you can replicate the feeling by walking into a room full of soup.
Yes.
That's what it feels like.
It's pretty thick
to
out
walk
there.
Outside.
Yeah, I mean, this time of year when we're recording this right now, it's very thick.
I'm not going to ask what kind of room you have or why you filled it with soup, what kind of soup. That should approximate the experience.
That's pretty good. Now, I'm sure I could talk about this for an hour probably or more.
Yeah.
There's a lot of little things, you know, that I'm still doing, trim work and all that, but
it's
not done. It'll take me some time to get it in position to sell it, you know, and I also want to drive it a little bit more around town, you know, maybe go out and get some ice cream some night, that kind of thing. Stuff that I haven't been able to do for the many years that I had it before, and now I'm forced to do it. But, anyway, it's for the better good, I guess. So I will be getting rid of it soon, but I'm also going to get some enjoyment out of it. And I hope that, you know, anybody out there listening who has a project car, you know, maybe this be a little bit of inspiration to, go out there and get it running and drive it around a little bit, because that's what they're all about. And I haven't been doing that for years, but now that I've got kind of the bug again, the fever, I can't stop thinking about it, even at work. So
I can tell you're ready to go now
and
get back to work on it.
I kind of am, yeah. I mean, aside from, you know, the garage humidity, because that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
That's true. You would have to, I mean, a lot of my friends, when they were doing project cars, especially if it was summer down here, I knew several guys who were like, I don't start work in the garage until after 5.
It's a smart move. I mean, really,
just
it
because,
is.
Because, you know, it gets so hot between like 1 and 4.
And even then, it's still, you know, it could be 90 degrees at 10 p.m. You know, it's ridiculous. So,
yeah.
And I know there's a lot of parts of the world that are like that. It's one of those things you just have to put up with your you know, the environment that you're dealt, I guess, or where you're living.
Yeah.
You got choice.
You have to be your own boss. You have to be accountable to yourself.
Yeah.
You know?
Maybe I should get a shirt made out of one of those, like, those synthetic chamois materials, you know, like the absorbent, you know, stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
That's a terrible thought.
I mean, I guess it would depend on the cut of it, but it does seem like it would result in diminishing returns eventually.
This is an uncomfortable conversation.
It sure is, but here, let's, I'll give you the one, I did say there was one weird thing that was not auto related that I just wanted your opinion on.
Okay.
And I want to hear your opinion on this too, listeners. And then we'll go out with a listener mail, and you have one more thing.
I have a little surprise for you, maybe.
Okay. You have a surprise. So before the surprise, this will be a surprise for you too, Scott. And I was hesitant to bring this up just because, again, it has nothing to do with cars, and it just blew my mind when I read it. There's a company in – I'm going to warn people, this is a little weird. There's a company in California calling itself Ambrosia, and for $8,000 a pop, they will give people blood transfusions, healthy people, blood transfusions from what they call young blood. The blood of people under like 25 years old.
Really?
With the idea being that it has medical benefits for them.
Hmm.
They're literally it smacks of vampirism to me.
Well, that's strange. I wonder what the results are of this. I mean, are there proven results for this? I mean, clearly there aren't.
There have been some studies about this kind of thing being helpful to mice, and people have been trying something like it. since the 1800s. But yeah, it hasn't worked out. Apparently it's legal.
Hmm. Man, well, I don't want to like make any of the mice in my house like feel younger and more active by any means. In fact, if anything else, I just want something to make them slower and easier to catch. But man, if I had maybe got one of these ambrosia transplants or transfusions.
Would you be in the garage all the live long day?
I might have been in there like 6 years ago doing stuff, you know?
So I wanted to ask you, listeners, just because this is something that I read earlier today that stuck in my head. Would you do this if the science was there? Because I kind of, you know, I'm a pretty skeptical person. So I think that this smacks of bad science, even though I just read a bunch of stuff about it. Apparently there are some legit things with mice, but I don't know if you should do that with people.
Well, I don't want to spread any rumors, but, you know, from what I've heard, I hear things around town.
Yeah.
I've heard that every Formula One driver has had this type of transfusion. That's what gives them those like crazy fast reflexes.
Is that what it is?
It is. That keeps them young, you know, young at heart. I mean, again, I don't want to spread any rumors. It's just what I've heard around town.
So would you do it though?
Would I do it? No. No.
I don't think I would.
No. I mean, why would you take the risk of a blood transfusion when you don't need a blood transfusion to begin with? I mean, what if that thing comes with like Hep C or something?
It's a great question.
Then you're in trouble, right? I mean, I'm sure they screen for all this stuff maybe, but, you know. Also, somebody who's, you know, donating.
Yeah,
you know,
where are they getting this blood?
Yeah, the young blood. Oh, man. Okay. I hadn't thought of this. So is there like a high school nearby or something?
Oh,
and
my
like
gosh.
Kids missing sometimes?
Oh, boy.
What's going on?
Oh, man.
No, I think it's probably a situation where people donate and, you know, they pay them for that. I would guess. I would hope.
Mm-hmm.
But man, what you said? $8,000 is what they charge you to.
Yeah, eight large.
Oh man.
But this okay. So
do they have to take a pint out in order to put a pint in? I don't know how that works.
I don't know. It's like 2 liters of plasma, man.
2 liters.
Apparently,
that's a lot.
That's a lot of that's a lot of plasma, at least.
Oh,
well, I'm just curious to hear what you think, ladies and gentlemen. So while you're telling us about your project cars, do also let us know if you would. If you would subscribe to a service that like this is just so creepy.
I just heard another rumor.
What's your other rumor?
I just heard this. It's around town. I mean, I hate spreading.
You're very connected.
I really do hate spreading rumors.
Yeah.
I do. But just to let you know what I heard.
Yeah. It's just between us and everybody.
As of 2017, every driver on the NASCAR circuit has also had this transplant or transfusion.
You know, it's just a rumor, but I had heard that too.
Yeah.
Somebody had mentioned that.
NASCAR and F1. I mean, we'll see if it spreads.
We'll see if it spreads. We'll see if it works out. So that was just, let's call that short attention span theater on my part. if that topic was too weird for our grab bag today, no worries. Please send any criticism or complaints directly to our complaint department. The email is jonathan.strickland@howstuffworks.com.
Absolutely. And that's a guaranteed response.
And we have time for one more thing.
Yeah. And this is maybe a surprise to you, Ben.
Yeah.
I posted about this on our Facebook page, but I'm not sure if you caught it or not.
All right.
There was something, and this is so bizarre. I mean, it's such a sign of the times, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But the times would be the 1930s.
Okay.
Okay. So, and just a little bit more free with the rules and regulations. Let's put it that way.
All right.
So this would blow your mind, really. And I'm going to show you some photos. If you were to see this in person right now, there was at one time such a thing as a roller coaster for cars. You could drive your own car on a roller coaster. What do you think of that?
I think that sounds awesome.
It does sound awesome. And it happened for real. And it wasn't just in one place, but I'm going to show you this photograph. Look at the bottom one in particular, because that's a good photo.
Oh, yeah. That's great. That's cool.
That is the photo that I posted on our Facebook page at Car Stuff HSW on Facebook. And, you can check that out. This one in particular, the one that I'm talking about was on a site called westparkhistory.com. And the West Park neighborhood, I guess, is a part of Cleveland, Ohio, you know, right around Cuyahoga County, right there in Ohio, right along the banks of the, I guess that would be Lake Erie.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that's the area that we're talking about. Now, you know, at the time, this is, again, this has all happened around the 1930s. We'll get to that in a minute. But roller coasters had been around, real roller coasters, you know, like the cars that you were on rails on, you know, the wooden coasters, had been around since about 1817. I think the first one was in Paris. And then by about the 1920s, it seemed like every single amusement park everywhere had a roller coaster of some kind.
So this fad just...
It was a big thing to do, yeah. Right? I mean, and West Park, this part of, again, of Cleveland, had their own... what they called a world-class roller coaster at the time, and they called it the Cyclone. Now, this is just a regular roller coaster, you know, still a thrill ride, still fun, but there was an old theme park there called Puritas Springs Park, and that was in existence from about 1928 until about 1956. But as we said, there were far fewer people, I guess, that knew about this other roller coaster that was right near where the Cleveland Airport is now. So this coaster, and we'll mention the name of the company that built it right now, is called American Amusement Corporation, and they built more than one. And the idea behind this is, again, it's a roller coaster for cars.
Yeah.
People paid a fee to drive their automobile over a series of 11 hills on a U-shaped elevated roadway constructed of wood. Now, the peak of each hill, they say, was about 9 feet high, and although I'm looking at the photos, and it looks a lot higher than that, but that must be right. But in the distance from crest to crest, so it's like a wave, if you want to think of it that way,
yeah.
From crest to crest was about 112 feet. And for about a dime, riders could experience the thrills and chills of a roller coaster without leaving their own car. So you could drive your own vehicle, even if it was, you know, a limousine,
yeah.
Or, you know, some rusty wreck of a jalopy. You know, you could take it out for about a dime. And apparently it was very, very popular. And they said that, you know, the very first day that it opened, which was, I believe, 1930. I wanted to say it was in May of 1930, somewhere around there.
Yeah. May 2nd.
May 2nd, that's right. They said that, you know, the lines to get on this thing lasted until, like, you know, the middle of the night, the wee hours of the morning, practically. It was so popular. So they built more than one. I guess there were other coasters like this that were popular on the West Coast, which I find just unbelievable. I don't think I'd seen these ever before until I saw this photo of the one that was in Cleveland. And Cleveland, or the area of Cleveland, in fact, had a second one. There's another suburb of Cleveland called Willoughby, Ohio. And Willoughby is, I believe it's a little bit further east and right on the banks of Lake Erie.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they say that it's hard to determine how long these things survive because nothing was really published about these roller coasters after the opening day because, you know, it was a sensation. You know, everybody
sure.
wanted to report on, you know, what was going on out there. And the operator, American Amusement Corporation, canceled its Ohio charter in November of 1932. So at the most, these things lasted, you know, maybe about 2.5 years at the most. You know, I know they have to go through a pretty difficult winter up there. I wonder if that had something to do with it, maintenance, you know, et cetera.
Sure.
And I guess, you know, you would think that there would be, you know, a problem with operating something like this, you know, danger, liability, that type of thing. But then again, as I said, it's kind of the sign of the times because it was 1930.
Right.
You know, they don't have the concerns that we have now. So when you look at the photographs, you just can't imagine somebody owning and operating that type of thing.
But they did have some safety regulations, right?
Yeah, sure they did. Yeah. Some safety, if you want to call it this. Now, they had that, if you look at the photo again, there's this wooden rail that reminds me a lot of the wooden rails that they would put up around the velodromes, you know, or the cyclodromes, or what do we call those? The wooden racetracks.
Yeah.
Yeah, those tracks, they had a wooden, like a 2x4 railing, and that's...
Which is not going to do anything.
No, I mean, it's a car that weighs, you know, 5,000 pounds or
right.
something. Think of the time. So anyways, the speed was limited to about 20 miles per hour. There were guidelines painted on the roadway. And the curves were banked, which is kind of nice, really. But the railings, I mean, there was really nothing preventing you from skidding off of this thing, really. I mean, the railings aren't going to hold up. Of course, no motorcycles were permitted because, I don't know, I guess they thought that, you know, they could go a little too fast or would be more tempted to go fast and make this thing more of a jump ride than,
yeah.
you know, like an autocross course or something.
Well, here's where they messed up.
What's that?
They said, okay, we're going to be reasonable. A second auto is not allowed to start until the first has been three hills away.
Oh, yeah. And of course, everybody's going to maintain the exact same speed, right?
Right. And
yeah.
everybody's going to be driving at the same level of expertise.
Oh, of course. So, you know, there's no worry about that car behind you slamming into you because it's out of control. Because they did say, and this is pretty remarkable, the dips and rises could actually throw cars out of control and sometimes the wheels would come slightly off the ground when you made these dips and rises, even at 20 miles per hour. So you get an idea of the feel in there. It must have felt pretty good. Like, you know, like
oh,
you get
yeah.
that kind of...
That rush?
Yeah, like your stomach is coming up into your throat type of feeling, you know?
Well, who hasn't when you... Okay. I don't know. I can't speak for every driver on the planet, but for most of the people I know, myself included, especially when you first get a car, one of the things that I was always on the lookout for, and I still am, to be honest with you, is any steep hill where I can try to catch some air.
Oh, yeah. Or like a one-lane bridge that has like a perfect jump. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
Yeah, something really dangerous, right? Yeah, that's always fun. So I guess the thing is with these coasters, the operator pulled out by 1932. I think we said November of 32.
Yeah,
and
very short-lived.
And then they know for sure that this auto roller coaster was gone by June of 1940 because they opened something called the West Side Drive-In Theater on that site right there at, I think it's at Rocky River Drive and Brook Park Road if you're in that area. Which they said was an odd location for driving because there was an airport nearby. And so, you know, you'd have the airplane noise and low planes and all that. But today, that former location of that automobile roller coaster is completely vacant right now. It's right next to the Berea Freeway. So if you're in that area, you can go check out, you know, where it once was. I don't know. There's going to be nothing there. It was a wooden coaster.
Uh-huh.
There's not like any rock structure or anything that remains. But, what an interesting little bit of history for that Cleveland area. And as we found out, West Coast had these as well. Mm-hmm. You know that there were other amusement, you know, companies that were opening stuff like this up, you know, all over the United States and probably all over the world. You know, why aren't we seeing photos of them? This is the first time I'd ever seen a car on a roller coaster like this.
I guess maybe because it was such a short-lived phenomenon.
Maybe, like it was a one-day news item.
Yeah, maybe other – well, okay, so two – let's be really generous and say 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So 2 years, that's enough time maybe for buzz to either die down a little bit or to start catching on. But it sounds like there must have just been a moment where people said this is too dangerous.
Yeah. You know? Well, think about the timing of this too.
Yeah.
Well, this is going to be right at the Depression.
That's true.
The very beginning of the Depression.
Yeah.
So maybe a lot of them didn't exist or had started, you know, maybe they started to build them and then realized that they were just not going to get anybody to ride on those things. And then we went right into World War II.
It's true.
And that it was a much more solemn time, I guess. People a little more serious about things. And who knows, maybe resources weren't given to, you know, amusement type stuff like this at that time. So maybe that's coming together, combining to kind of, I guess push this out of the history books, but
I would totally do it if there wasn't anyone in front of me.
Yeah, would you?
Yeah,
would you?
Are
okay.
you kidding? That's
well, yeah,
that's
sure.
so cool.
I think it'd be great. Yeah,
I
it
wanted
might be
to be in a junky car.
I was going to say it might be a little rough on your vehicle.
Yeah, I wouldn't be in my car.
I mean, there are stories of this. There's a guy who's probably an old timer now,
uh-huh.
But he's talking about how his uncle took, I guess it would be this guy's dad's car, so his brother's car, a brand new. I think it was a. It was a Chrysler Royale or something like that. And he said, my father wasn't even with us. And we took this thing on, you know, quite a thrill ride on this roller coaster. But he said, you know, it was like the time of his life at the time. He's scared to death, but it was a lot of fun. And he still remembers it now. But, you know, this guy, if he was a kid in 1930, he's got to be pretty old. I mean, whenever this was reported, I think the story comes from, well, I don't know when it was posted, but again, westparkhistory.com, if you want to see some photographs and, you know, just search auto roller coaster, you'll probably find a few. But I'd like to know elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, these things appeared and we just never heard of them or photos.
And I'd like to know if you would do it.
If I would do it?
In somebody else's car.
In a rental car.
In a rent? You do it in a rental car?
I do it in a rental car, yeah.
All right. Good Not luck even. Turning it back in.
Yeah, maybe I'd do it in the project car before I sold it.
Why not, man?
Yeah, why not?
And as we say every time we do this episode, it looks like we ran out of time before we got to all the stuff we wanted to cover. However, we will be back next week. And in the meantime, if you'd like to learn more car stuff or get more information about some of the things we mentioned on the show, check out our website, carstuffshow.com, and visit us on Facebook and Twitter, where we post all sorts of things. It's sort of an ongoing nuts and bolts, that you read instead of hear.
It's good. good way to think of it.
It's all right.
Yeah.
And, of course, our best ideas for upcoming topics come from you. If you'd like to write to us directly with a topic that you think your fellow listeners would love to hear, let us know. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.